Welcome to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have Daniel Korenev, CEO of Sentius. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Mashtaba. Pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, thank you very much for accepting my invitation for the podcast. So, Daniel, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and your company, Sentius?
Sure. I'm in the industry for 20 years. I first got fascinated by the idea of technology when I was reading science fiction, even earlier than that. About 20 years ago, in 2004, I learned that Bill Gates wanted to create a very smart intelligent system inside Windows. I loved that idea. Sadly, Microsoft did not succeed in doing that at the time. It was way ahead of time. But that led me to join the company and find other projects inside, get friends with salespeople, learn from amazing people at the top of the company of what kind of things you can do with AI, even before it became super popular. And after that, I started my first company. I worked on it for several years. I went through a time when my grandpa died, and that really put me into a huge depression. I worked for NASA's auto company. I built part of his AI system. Spent more than 3.5 years in the research lab as a deputy head of lab. We got published at top conferences like ACL, EMNLP, and so on. And for the last year and a half, I'm working, about a year, a couple of months probably, I'm working for Sentius. And it's my second company, which actually, oddly enough, a little bit incorporates what I worked on the first one.
I see. Great. So, Daniel, what inspired you to start Sentius?
I have a very simple idea. I really love history. And when I look at history and the way how people work, you see a very simple idea. When people want to do something by their own, they're quite limited. We are not the most powerful species. We need a lot of clothes to survive in different climates. But when we get the lever, any kind of lever, we suddenly can do much more. Like a stick, you can get any kind of stuff from the trees. You can kill an animal or something like that. Now, that was like first thing. The other thing that we created was the idea that different people can do different things, specialization. And when you create specialization, you also create organization as a concept, where different people work together to get things done. So organization is like the second big lever for us to make things happen. And obviously, people are not great in everything. And you want to be maximum optimal, reach maximum effect of maximum efficiency of work. And to do that, you need to bring as much energy and as much workforce as you can. And that's where AI comes in play. So what I want to do is to make organizations upgraded where they can tap into AI and use it. And we call it agentic organization. So I want to do the third step. First was lever, second is organization, third is agentic organization. Uh-huh. Hope it makes sense.
It somewhat makes sense. So if you tell us more about Sentius, what are you trying to solve? What's the challenge you are trying to solve here?
The very big challenge that we are focused on is how to enable organization to get maximum result of its hybrid workforce. Mm-hmm. That means we need to give tools to, first of all, see that workforce, and we build a no-code studio for that, which is a little bit similar to how you play real strategy games in the past, like StarCraft. You have a territory, and then you have lots of different things happening. Then we have digital workers or AI agents, and the first AI agents we're building is browser agent. It allows you to control different kind of websites, and you give it an instruction initial language, and it performs it. It can do it in zero-shot mode, where I have never seen the task before. But the cool thing about it is, you would not really trust someone who is wearing you to do anything uncontrollably in the company, like an intern. Same with agents. So we added a mechanism to show agents how to perform tasks that they can learn, acquire skills like we humans do, and then plug that into the organization. Then the third thing that we do is a workflow engine that allows us to connect people and agents together to work on complex workflows. So these are three product elements of what we're building. And then there is a fourth piece. It's a mechanism we call recurrent memory transformer technology. So the idea behind this is the following. When you think how you want to run agents, you want to be sure that they are smart enough. Smartness is all going down to two ideas, reasoning and planning. Now, models are not really good by design and reasoning complaining. That's not exactly how their architecture is designed. And there are lots of studies showing that they're not really good in that. So, for example, O1 model from OpenAI, it uses a lot of very intelligent techniques to change the architecture of their underlying LLM to make reasoning. So we also done this kind of technology from our side, a bit different, because we can't remember transformers. The idea behind is this: you grab data, you give context of data to a large language model, and this large language model, it gets a hybrid architecture. Partially it is a transformer, but partially it's a recurrent neural network. And when you give it data, it can memorize necessary pieces of what's incoming into it, and then it can reason much better about it. It was so good that last year we gave models 2 million context window. 2 million tokens context window got published and sifted. And this year at the AAA conference, we were featured with the thing. But we kept moving, working not on just like long context, but on the way how model understands the context. So we added the idea of what we call associative memory tokens, where model, when it looks at data, it kind of builds a very distilled representation of what it understood. Structured representation, if you like, in a way that allows it to reason about the data. And we created a benchmark called Babylon that will be featured next week at Neurips in Vancouver. And that benchmark shows that there is no other model in the world than an RMT model that is doing so well in reasoning of a large context. Nobody else is close. Even Google with their Gemini model, when they shipped 1 million token context window model back in February, and not Mamba, whose architecture is a little bit similar to our early architecture, but they fall down after, I think, 200,000 tokens or something. Nobody else got closer to us. So
That's awesome, what we do. Awesome. Great. Thanks very much, Daniel. So how do you envision the role of autonomous agents in transforming the traditional business processes?
Well, there are several things to think about. First of all, there is a great book about diffusion of innovation that illustrates how any kind of new technology is being adopted. I mean, some people probably have heard about Gartner's old cycle of innovation. I like the diffusion of innovation book. And the concept is very similar. At the beginning, you have a lot of people, you call them innovators, who are really passionate about playing with toys. I mean, I'm one of them too. I have some foldable computers, for example, at my home. But I play and I leave them, you know, and I move on to this next game, okay, the next toy. But then there is a second group called early adopters. And early adopters, they do not just want to toy with the game, with the new technology, right? What they want to do is to see if that new technology, not fully developed, if it has a potential to make their companies more competitive against everybody else, because they can tap on the technology very early. Once technology is good enough, it moves through the gap, a huge gap between early adopters and early majority. And this is a huge gap. If you cross a gap, then this technology starts to be adopted by big companies. And there's the early adopters and early majority, and then there's late majority, and there's the laggards. And just to give a perspective, like early majority, late majority laggards, I think it's about like 80% of the market, or maybe 90% of the market. So what you have before the gap is a very small one. So it's like, imagine you want to give a fire and you start fire with a very, very small thing. And if it goes well, you get yourself a very nice fire in your camp. If you're not, then you fail. Agents are very early. That means that while some very specific agents can be really good, more general purpose kind of technologies that, like, for example, we are looking at, it needs to get through all of these phases. And it takes a bit longer, but the impact is much bigger. So moving through those phases is a necessary element to make technology used by everybody. Not sure if I fully addressed the question, so feel free to ask more.
Yeah, sure. As I've seen, you at Sentius have chosen enterprise for your field of action. Can you tell us more about this choice and what motivated you to focus specifically on enterprise?
Sure. Well, that's very simple. It goes back to two things. First is the idea of organization level. And second is the idea of scale. I mean, one of the things you learn when you work for big corporations like Microsoft or Google, and I was very fortunate to work for both of them, is you quickly realize how big can be your impact if you work at scale. And it's the same story with organizations. Anytime you help a particular organization, you can, through it, have a huge impact on the world. Helping enterprise to get things done means you can get a bigger impact. On the other hand side, when enterprise builds something, usually something useful for society. And so when you combine those two things together, that means you can make big impact on something that's super useful for society. It can be rockets. It can be transportation. It can be logistics and shipping. It can be manufacturing. It can be myriads of different things. Mm-hmm. And you can make impact quickly. On the other side, when you go and help individual people, that's very nice. It's very cool. But they just cannot have the same scale of impact as a big organizations can. So I like the fact that you can help individual people. I actually made a TEDx talk about that about nine years ago. But when I think how we can help quickly, enterprise is the right way.
Awesome. So, Daniel, you know, right now, big companies like OpenAI, Cloud, and etc. are doing their works and shipping very fast their features, their models, and etc. And actually, one of the things that makes it riskier doing startups in this field is the speed of this field and, you know, features that these big companies deliver. How do you plan to avoid being disrupted by these big companies and having a competitive edge for, you know, surviving in this field?
Well, one of the most important things is to understand your role in this whole story. One of the things that Microsoft taught me, and it's probably very cool that I got to work at Microsoft first, not at Google, for example, is Microsoft is a platform company. It very quickly teaches you that software market is a huge supply chain. Or value chain, if you like. And every player has a role. You need to understand where you are in that map. And you should not like compete with somebody you don't have resources to compete with. So I'm not trying to compete with OpenAI. In fact, we use OpenAI models as part of our work as well. And we don't want to compete with Anthropic. Actually, their computer-used model is something we are integrating into our software stack as we speak. Instead, what we want to do and continue doing is to provide all the necessary infrastructure that will give these agents to the companies. And that's a lot of stuff that might sound boring for some people. For example, about months ago, I was at AGI House Hackathon, and I showcased with a friend of mine. His name is also Daniel, by the way. He's from Stanford. So we showcased how you can inject a policy checking system that would not allow Anthropic computer use to perform particular actions on a website. For example, we would say, you do anything, but when you go to banking, do not allow people to transfer more than, I don't know, $200 per transaction, and do not allow more than 3 transactions at the time. And we can inject that. And there are a lot of these kind of small details and things that are necessary for agents to operate in an organization scale. It's coordination, it's policies, it's version control.
I see.
It's a lot of different things. And that's not something that companies that provide foundational models are interested in doing. What they want to do is to have other companies build on top of them and create their own part of value. So together, we all provide value to end users, which can be people or, in our case, organizations. We do not compete. Mm-hmm. We play together to give as much of AI capability to companies worldwide.
Awesome. So as they ship more powerful models, it's in your advantage, actually.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome, awesome. So, Daniel, how do you see the moat here for startups? How startups can create moats for their AI product?
That's a good question because it goes back to what you compete with. As long as you understand that you're not competing with, for example, OpenAI, do not have to think about the modes that would help you here. For us, when we talk about enterprise software, funny enough, it starts with relationships. So when you want to find the first customer, and usually you call them a design partner, you want to build a good relationship with them. You want to deeply understand what kind of problems they go through as a company. You want to be sure that you can address those kind of problems. And when you build those kind of things, that means you also build your reputation. And over the time, that's a very important piece of the puzzle. You might think it's not an element of the puzzle, but in the fact, the whole cycle of selling is very long. When you sell it to a 20-team company, it's fine. It's very quick. But the company can die in half a year, and they can very quickly stop being your customer. And then you're at square one. And when you go to a bigger company, it's a different story. So reputation plays a huge role. And that means that our software has to be very reliable. And from our side, obviously, we focus on reliability of our agents. In fact, there is an announcement of a couple of companies that happened in the last couple of weeks. Hurra from here, from Silicon Valley, and Edge from Paris. And both of them measured their browser agents against a benchmark called Web Voyager that was created back in January. And there is also one more company called Agent Emergence, and they published an agent called Agent E. So everybody claims that they have state of the art. And everybody focuses, you know, like, can we solve a problem? We have never seen that problem before. And everybody say, yeah, we can do 56%. Yeah, we can do 66%, something like that. But when you really talk to real company and ask them, do they really want agents to do autonomously anything you want? They're goddamn scared. Imagine you have a $1 billion flaw when people send a mail, for example, and say, I want to fly from point A to point B, or they want to ship goods. And you put the agents into that flow, and they start to do anything they want. I mean, this got them terrible. Nobody wants that. Like last year, Canada Air, I think, they had a story when they had a chatbot. And the chatbot invented a refund policy, if I'm not wrong, about that. And the judge said that Canada Air has to comply with that goddamn policy. The policy was invented. So you don't want to do that. You want to have a very reliable system. And we spent about a year working on our browser agent technology to make it super reliable. So yes, it can figure out how to solve a problem at the beginning using zero-shot approach, but it remembers how it's done. And we can also teach it how to get things done if it's got wrong. And we ensure that it's super reliable in executing those tasks before we can give it an access to a controlled enterprise environment to perform exactly the task that is asked to be done. And that's super important. So a relationship and reliability, and those two go together. If you're not reliable, we cannot maintain complex and good relationship over the time. So in the end, it goes back to reliability. Yeah.
I see. Great. But as I know, Sentius also has human in the loop mechanism for critical and sensitive areas, right?
Yes. That's a very obvious thing. And again, that's something we learned from our first customers is, yes, you want agent to perform particular tasks, but then you want to be sure that people can look at it and say, yeah, it's okay. Or maybe we need to make some kind of changes over down the road. Human as a component is obviously essential to the enterprise environment.
Awesome. So Dan, can you tell us a few use cases that Sentius are good at and actually can do in the enterprise?
So one of the stories is in case of aviation is, so the companies, they have internal software. And I cannot go into specifics, we have NDA and everything. But basically that software, it has to be automated somehow. Mm-hmm. And you always have, let me probably change the gears, okay, if you don't mind.
I see. Yeah.
I can show another example. It's more interesting. So it actually goes down to your compliance story, your QIC story that we talked about in the beginning. Yeah. So imagine that you want to go to a company and you want to be sure that you can give it the right insurance. And you want to be sure that the company is compliant with a particular set of policies. There are certifications, you know, there are policies, there are acts like GDPR, California Privacy Act, and so on. So you want to check how your potential customer is actually compliant with things. So some of the actions you can do by writing code, okay? And you can, for example, go and check that everything, all the data that is stored in AWS or Azure, for example, is properly secured, no unsecured access, and so on and so forth. So they have similar kind of things, but for example, in Google Workspace environment or Microsoft 365 environment. And for some of those things, you might not be even able to get API access at all, or you would have to get restricted API access from the company. Or you can ask our browser agent to go through SharePoint websites or Google Docs information and look for all the stuff, look at all the policies that the system has to be compliant with and give you a report of what's going on. are we compliant with those policies, or whether there is something that is going wrong? Like, for example, when I worked for Microsoft, we had this classification of data from confidentiality perspective. So some of the data was available to all employees. Some of the data was on need-to-know basis for only employees for a particular division. And then some of the data could be available only to top leadership team or to specific business units inside a bigger organization. So that's the same kind of thing. Not everybody can operate at Microsoft scale. And it can be very, very challenging to ensure that you are compliant with policies. So what our software is able to do and is doing is it just checks all those things and gives you back a report of how good or how bad things are. The cool part about this is you don't even have to do any kind of action, edit anything. You just check that stuff is done, just stuff is not done. Then obviously you can ask the system to do the necessary changes. But in the beginning, you do not have to do even that. You just have to put it, go and check things. You cannot do it with Kroger. You cannot do it with other kind of ways. And obviously when you ask people to do it, you know, hourly rate and everything. And I mean, it's kind of boring task. You just want to delegate to browser agent right away.
Awesome. Great. Great. Thanks, Daniel. So Daniel, what emerging technologies or trends in AI and specifically AI agents are you most excited about right now?
Well, let me put it this way. I am super excited about agents in general because this is a very long time ago idea. Idea that was born a very long time ago. 1986, Marvin Minsky, he wrote a book, The Society of Mind, where he described something that we can call agents today. In 1993, some economists, they coined this term autonomous agents, actually wrote a blog post about that in April. A lot of people experiment with autonomous agents between this and today. It's just today technology became finally capable of us to build those agents in the first place. What I'm super excited is to see when agents will not only help us in software, but help us in hardware. When they will go beyond software, get embodied, or in other words, get bodies, if you like, and start to do actions in the outer world. I cannot wait to see it because I want to see most of the great things from science fiction to become true faster than later. I want to see as much better transportation. I want them to see colonizing Moon, colonizing Mars, going to asteroid belt and other things. And follow that, we need to be much more efficient and productive than we are today. And agents are a fantastic and super necessary piece, a foundational piece of the technology that will make all of that possible. This is, I believe, the most important thing we do in the industry. Yes, longevity is cool. Yes, we need to fight cancer. But in software, AI agents are the cornerstone for the next kind of industrial revolution, if you like. Yeah, like 10 years ago, people were saying 3D printing is element of the next industrial revolution. Yes, I can agree. It's an important piece. But it doesn't incorporate the same as a very important idea that a lot of work just has to be done by those who are doing it the best. And agents, embodied or not embodied, are positioned to be the best in the world to perform a lot of tasks.
Awesome, awesome. So you suppose that our robots are kind of agents, right?
Of course. I mean, the whole concept of agent is something that is autonomous enough to perform tasks. It's not clarified that agent has to perform on the actions inside the software environment. From the other side, I wrote about that in my diploma about 16 years ago, that when you want to build a system that can react to changes of the environment, I mean, in the end, like when you think about who you are some sort of, I don't know, software in your brain that processes signals coming from your hands, from your skin, from your ears, from your nose and everything. So in the end, we are kind of agents. We just are embodied in physical human bodies with all that limitations, their benefits. The same goes with the software. When you build the AI agent and give it a body, it's very much the same thing. You need to give sensors. You need to have a mechanism to understand what data comes in and what it means and so on. But other than that, it's the same kind of thing. It's just a matter of what kind of body we're in.
Yeah, totally agree. So, Daniel, when do you think we'll get to the AGI?
That's a very different question. It goes back to definition of what artificial general intelligence is. There is this idea of super intelligence, human intelligence. I think the most important way, and I'm not sure if I'm right about that or not, just my opinion, but I think the best way to think about artificial general intelligence is to measure how good it is at understanding and managing complexity. What we humans are very good at is building complexity. They're not really good at managing that complexity, but we're really good at building it. When we will see technology being able to understand complexity, maintain complexity, for example, one planet, that's going to be super exciting. When it will be able to expand towards other planets in our solar system, that would be even better. But right now, we are very far from that. Yes, when you have a AI model inside a software we call agent, and we connect all the necessary external data, like sensors, to understand things and so on, it's very, how to put it, you really feel tempted to call it AI. Like, call it a, not just AI, but like a real intelligence. But it's not yet there. We still have to get through several barriers before we go back. Actually, we have a vision with my co-founder, Mike Burtsev, and there are so many things that we still need to get things done correctly. There's learning component, long-term memory, short-term memory. And a lot of experiments are done. A lot of things like RAC, for example, are done for that. But a lot of things are still in infancy. We still have to do a lot of things before we can get there. So, I don't know, 5 to 10 years sounds something like where we can see some of the breakthroughs. Usually people very much overestimate what can be done in the next few years, underestimate what can be done in 5 to 10. So yeah. I'm going to stick with a more conservative approach here.
Awesome. So Daniel, Sentius is aiming at doing some of the labor works, and we spoke of AGI, and one of the concepts, really important concepts, is right now AGI, post-AGI economy. So what do you think about post-AGI or the economy in 5 to 10 years from now? Or even 2 to 3 years from now, you know, your agents will be able to do the jobs that right now humans are doing. What do you think next years will look like, considering many of these jobs will be done by AI agents?
That's a very good question, because I'm not going to say that I agree with those who believe that agents are going to replace everything or AGI is going to replace everything. I'm probably a little bit more humanistic in my beliefs. I think that what we're going to see later on, and that's what we are working on in our company anyway, is that we're going to have hybrid workforce. I believe that people will still have their own part and their own contribution to work. And it might be creativity, probably. It might be ability to learn, ability to create original ideas that have value. So I think what we're going to see is this transition, simplification of the way how you can be involved in different kind of projects. And you would see a lot of people working side by side with agents, human form, not human form, and software form. And that's what we're going to see. The question, and a very good question, is, are we going to see people jobless or not? And how would they be able to, you know, survive? That's a very interesting question. I feel, and I think I share perspective of many people here in Silicon Valley, that we're going to have some sort of unified base income, something like that, because we need to give people foundation to not worry about tomorrow. And if we give their jobs to technology, if we not give them a lot of jobs after that, that means that we either make them sent to, I don't know, become bums, or we want to see them somehow to be contributing to the society. And I believe the first way is wrong. And I feel like nobody's going to agree with the first approach. Maybe a few people, but mostly it's just kind of stupid. So the second option is right. And I've seen several studies on UBI. I think they run something here in the States, something in Scandinavia, maybe. I'm not sure about that. Where exactly, but somewhere in Northern Europe. And those experiments show that when people have basic needs met, they have much less levels of stress, and they can actually be quite useful and productive in work. So I think that's where we're going to get to at some point. And then, I mean, this is an important piece. If you look at this from the zero-sum game, then this is wrong. I mean, if Earth would be the only planet in the whole universe, that could kind of make sense. Thankfully, we are not. We can colonize Mars. We can colonize moon, we can go to asteroid belt. At some point, we're going to go to the next solar system, next solar system, and so on. We can go to the galaxy at some point. So that means that our desire, our innate desire to increase the area of our habitat will push us forward. And there will always be place for people to work on that. We will see much more frontiers, like we saw those frontiers in the United States. And people will be involved in that kind of thing. So I don't think that we're going to end up in a dystopian world where people are not going to work and don't have money. I think instead of that, we will see a lot of growth outwards. And I really want to live long enough to be part of the growth. I want to have my house on Mars.
Hopefully. Yeah, let's pray for that. So, Daniel, on another topic, what's your take about the current state of investments and VC funding in the AI space for companies like yourself?
Well, in general, I think what ChatGPT made to the world and investment was a healing effect. I remember when 2022 started and how they say helicopter money stopped going down to people, and we started to see fundamental shifts in the global economy. It felt like it would be very hard to raise money for anything, be it AI or not AI, but ChatGPT definitely changed the trend. Is it easier to raise money? Well, I've seen several companies raising money from very simple things. Good names like you work as an intern OpenAI, you can easily raise money. Well, I'm not sure every intern from OpenAI can raise money. And I think it all goes down in the beginning to the right founding team, to right mentors, and so on. But in general, I think it's still relatively easy to raise, relatively easy. But you need to hit specific milestones, and you need to show investors that you minimize risk so that they could be more sure that they, at their stage, can actually invest into you, your company, and do not have to, you know, write your company down, write your company off, I mean. So it's available. You have to go and build your stuff. And the most important thing is, you know, a lot of people started to work on AI space just because there is money here and there's kind of opportunity here. And I'm not going to say those people are wrong. But what I want to do is to encourage those who are passionate about the space. I believe that those people will be rewarded better because they will build great things. If you're passionate, if you have original ideas, if you want to, how to put it, to show to the world who you really are, go out there. You will get resources. You will get help from VCs. You need, obviously, to learn how to play the game, but you can do it. And you should do it, because the worst thing you can do is to waste your life. And the worst you can do is to say no to your dream, especially if you paid a lot of energy and life effort to get somewhere. In my case, I was passionate about AI before everybody was so passionate about it. And I remember people looked at me and they were not really understanding why do I care about all of that. And fortunately, several very smart people at Microsoft, they saw my passion, my potential, and they supported me over the years. And when ChatGPT thing started, I cannot express how happy I was that finally my time has come. So for everybody else who is in a very similar boat like me, who dedicated part of their lives to AI space, don't be afraid. Go, come here to Silicon Valley, you will be heard. Go to AI House Hackathons, go to all the cool events here, but most importantly, build things and learn from customers what exactly you need to build. And money will come, support will come, and you will prevail. You will succeed.
Awesome, awesome. Thanks, Daniel. So, Daniel, what do you think about people who say that we are in an AI bubble?
It's a very common thing. A lot of people think that we are in an AI bubble. Are we in the bubble? I don't think we are in the end of the bubble for sure. Are we in the middle? I saw some statistics shown before, and it does not look like we are similar to what we had with .com. What is similar, though, is that by the end of .com, nobody would say that we have an internet company. Every company became an internet company. The same thing happens with AI. Nobody will say that we are an AI company. Everybody is an AI company. The question is just at what degree, how much of AI you use in your technology, which is kind of obvious. I don't think we are going to be exactly in a bubble. But what I think is happening is at some point, we're going to probably hit the wall. Maybe we're not. But when we will hit the wall, when we realize that this is just how much we can get, that's how much we can get to, that will be the moment where economy will say, okay, let's adjust a little bit to our expectations. But what the cool thing we see is, despite the fact that some people believe that we hit the wall, we have not. For example, one model from OpenAI, it shows that you can do a lot of cool stuff, not in the learning phase, but during the inference phase. Or for example, there are companies like Cerebras that create new chips that are specifically designed to run neural networks more efficiently than even NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. And that's another example. There's a lot of work with the agentic space and a lot of concepts that finally are, how to put it, are something that you can actually use because of all the other advances in this space. So amount of things we can build in AI is still fascinating, and I don't think we're going to hit any kind of wall soon. I think what we're going to see is AI penetrating more and more areas of our economy, and only once it absorbs fully, we can say that, yeah, maybe that's the end of the bubble if we ever been in a bubble. But my feeling is we're not in the bubble. Mm-hmm, anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, awesome. So do you think the way to improve these models is to just scale, or we'll need some kind of other frameworks other than transformers?
First, I believe that we need hybrid architectures, neural network architectures. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what my co-founder worked on for a very long time. His work on neural architecture search showed amazing fruits with this RMT and RMT models. And they already show you that when you add those components to the original transformer model, you can make it much smarter in understanding the data that comes into the model than anything else in the market. You also see other kind of architectures that are coming to us. And when you think about that, that's super fascinating. Let me see. So yeah, I mean, this different new architectures is something that is still upcoming. One of the funny things is recurrent neural networks, they got a second attention from everybody because turns out you can train them and get some cool results from them as well. As I said, the hybrid stuff you work on is also similar to that. And another great example, I think, for an encouraging one is the story with Andrei Karpaty. He worked at OpenAI, then he moved to Tesla. He drove its autopilot program. He moved back to OpenAI, and then he left OpenAI to work on his own stuff. And, I mean, he's phenomenal. But one of the things that was super phenomenal about his work is that even prior to leaving OpenAI for the second time, he worked on GPT-2. And GPT-2 is the last open-source model from OpenAI, right? And you can play with it. We actually also play with it. Actually, our RMT model is based on GPT-2 architecture. And he showed that you do not have to put a lot of data into the model for it to be smart. You just need to ensure that the data quality itself would be much higher than it usually is. And that gives a lot of hope to us. We are not partners with Qualcomm. But I'm very excited about what Qualcomm and everybody else is doing in this space. Right now, I'm talking to you from my Surface Pro 11 with Snapdragon X Elite CPU. But it has a neural processing unit. It's not the same as what Cerebras is doing, but in the way how typical people will look, it's very similar. That is that you have specific hardware designed to run language models and other AI models. And when you think about this, you realize that all of these advancements in hardware and software, they're just happening in front of us, continuing. We see how new architectures bring us new possibilities. We see how hardware allows us to be more efficient in running those things. One of the most fascinating things for me is initially for browser agent, we would need to use something like GPT-4. But if you grab the same open source model from Meta, for example, and make it much smaller, not billions of parameters, but not hundreds of billions of parameters, but maybe like several billions of parameters model, give it much more high quality data and train it to solve particular tasks, you can run the model on a physical device. So we can run this agent on a physical device. And it can be running there, so we can trust that it will do stuff that only you will see because you would not even send data anywhere at all. When I think about that, it opens up even more possibilities. Mm-hmm. I cannot express how amazed I am at what we do in this space. It's just fascinating. At every single space, you have new hardware that runs in the cloud. You have new hardware that runs on physical devices. You have new architectures that appear and that show that there are no limits to what you can do. So, yeah, super fascinating time.
Yeah, totally agree. So, Daniel, what is your long-term vision for Sentius and how do you plan to move forward with Sentius?
There are several things. Obviously, we need to have more kinds of agents to address different kind of things in software side first. Then I want to see us when we will be super efficient in combining people and agents together, software agents and people together and doing work. We will definitely have to expand towards physical world. We're going to have robots. We already experimented with robots a couple of years ago in the research lab prior to building this company. So opportunities there is amazing. It just takes more time to get robots done fast and efficient. And again, I don't think that we're going to build a lot of own hardware or software that's going to run the brains of the things as much as we're going to build all the necessary infrastructure to make that happen. And what is the crazy examples from science fiction is probably a valiant corporation from the movie called Prometheus, where the company at some point participated in, you know, in colonizing different worlds and so on. Now, that's a big dream. Big dream. I don't know if it's going to happen in my lifetime or not. But I'm pretty sure is that there will be several big companies that will be focused on in making everybody else super efficient and super productive. And I want to see my company to be one of them. And that means we have to span across software and physical bodies with agents inside. That's absolutely obvious.
Awesome. So Daniel, as a big fan of sci-fi, what are your favorite books and movies in this field?
Sure, thank you. Several things. I like Asimov a lot. His story about the foundation was amazing. The idea that you can predict the future of society and prepare for changes and long-term thinking, that was super amazing. His books about robotics and three laws of robotics, they're super interesting. I mean, most people would say that those three laws were not really working. If you look at all his books, you will see that those laws don't really work. And every story shows you how exactly they don't work. But they're exciting in a way that they inspire you to think beyond what can be done today. One of the amazing books that I think Asimov wrote was called Profession, where people would at some point get super cool device at the age of 18. They would connect to that device and device would figure out what their brains are wired to, like to do, like you can be doing work of, a teacher, or you can do work in engineering or other kind of things. And then some people would be designed such a way that their brains are not predefined to do anything. And those people, they would be sent to a specific place. They would think that this is like a hospital for brain dead people. It's not. Actually, it's a place where those people whose brains are not pre-wired to do something specific are actually taught so that they would become researchers and figure out the next big things to happen. And when I think about Asimov, that's super inspiring to see. I want to see this huge civilization of ours moving forward and forward. And I think he wrote the longest story about the future civilization than anybody else. But the other author that I really adore is probably Philip Dick. There are multiple movies created based on his stories. Matrix was inspired by his book, Ubik. And that's just one of the examples. Total Recall, there are two movies called Total Recall. And then there is movies with Tom Cruise about Special Opinion. I'm not sure if I'm saying it correctly. I watched it in a different language before. But that's also a very beautiful movie. There are multiple movies. Adjustment Bureau, for example. And Paycheck with Ben Affleck. All those movies, they teach you that reality that you interact with, you can think of it as something that you can change and that it's not exactly what it is. So it kind of teaches you that it can create some sort of reality distortion field, like what Steve Jobs done. And it also teaches you that you need to be able to try to think behind how to put it out of the box. And that's super useful. It teaches you to abstract things. It teaches you to build a mental model of the world, evolve it over time, do not accept it at face value. And it's amazing. And the third thing, sorry about that, but the third book, the third author I loved is Alfred von Vogt. He wrote several books about the future empires of human civilization and so on. But he also wrote about the world of null R. The idea is that you can have a non-Aristotelian understanding of the reality. So basically, in Aristotelian logic, you have yes or no, like zero and one in bits, right? And when you think of this way, it's very easy to say, this is enemy, this is friend, this is that, this is this. But the problem is when you actually try to interact with reality, you see that things are not black and white. Our perception of things makes them black and white, but they are not. And most importantly, every time we look at something in the world, we see only part of it. And we understand only what we can understand, what we can comprehend. So if, for example, we don't understand physics, we can think that this is magic, Arthur Clarke would say. But the reality is we just don't understand the complexity of the world. So he wrote those books because he was passionate by the book. Passionate about the books that Alfred Kozhevsky wrote, and he was one of the big philosophers of the last century. And Kozhevsky, he inspired Engelbart. Engelbart created Mother of All Demons. He was the guy who invented the mouse. He was the guy who inspired people on Zero Spark to create desktop metaphor, all the computers we have today. Going back to science fiction, it's amazing that when you go back to it, you go back to original ideas, and then you figure out that those original ideas very much shaped the whole civilization already. Exactly. And when you go back to those ideas, you realize that some of them can be foundation of what you do. Still, they can be foundation of what you can do. And then you can mix them with new ideas and lay down the path to the future that we want to be seen and want to make happen.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, awesome. Thanks, Daniel. So, Daniel, where can our listeners find you online?
I'm on Twitter. My handle is Dani Yelko, Daniel Korniff. K-O. It's my alias at Microsoft that I have. I still maintain it because I created a Twitter account around that time. I'm on Facebook and I write there quite regularly. So be prepared. I spam a lot. And my company handle is Sentios AI without the dot on Twitter. Same as LinkedIn, I believe. And I think the same is with Facebook. So feel free to subscribe to me and my company on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Awesome. We will surely put links on the description of the podcast. Well, Daniel, it was great having you on the All Things XR podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me aboard. Lovely questions.